the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. On this week's episode, we return to some sense of normality after the sacking of Vahid Halilhodžić dominated discussion on the previous two episodes. Well, I say that, but the Yokohama versus Shonan game on Saturday afternoon was anything but normal, and Sean Galbraith returns to the pod to fill us in on the 4-4 thriller the two Kanagawa clubs fought out at Nissan Stadium, while we also review the rest of J1 Match Day 9. And then later in Part 2, John Steele guests to discuss his trip to Nishigaoka to watch Tokyo Verdy and Mito on Saturday, and the state of play in J2 after 10 rounds of the season. The J-Talk Podcast starts now. We've discussed Ange Postecoglou's Yokohama at length several times on the pod so far this season, but at the risk of overkill, we had to go back to the well on this week's episode after F. Marinos played out the game of the J1 season so far, a 4-4 thriller against Shonan on Saturday afternoon. And to discuss it, it's my pleasure to welcome Sean Galbraith back to J-Talk. Sean, how are you? Your heartbeat just about returned to normal?
Yeah, more or less. I think the usual dose of about, eight different types of medicine Japanese doctors give you, they're starting to kick in. So, yeah, a bit coked up today, but hopefully, it won't be too much trouble.
Well, yes, we're recording a day or night later than usual after, Sean came down with a bit of something on Monday night. I hope that your supporting F. Marinos hasn't turned into a bit of a health hazard for you, Sean.
It's definitely bad for your heart, after that game on Saturday there, I think.
So, some will be wondering why we're leading with a game between the sides who sit 14th and 15th in the table after 9 games. But frankly put, and you can tell the listeners far, far better than I can, of course, because you were there, Sean. I mean, this was simply an instant J1 classic at the Nissan Stadium. Some of the defending, to be fair, was certainly not in that category, but an absolute clinic in finishing, especially from the dueling strikers Hugo Vieira and Alan Stevanovic, who we'll speak about at length, obviously, as we recap the game.
Yeah, I mean, what a game for a neutral, right? Imagine that was your first J-League game and you saw it was 4-3 at halftime, right? So you're thinking it could be 8 goals in the next half as well, but not great if you're a fan, right? I mean, we thought we were ahead, then we're behind, then we're ahead again, and then nothing. And it's, I mean, I recommend everybody watches the game. As a Marinos fan, I don't really want to watch it again because it's painful at times. And, there was almost a sense of kind of dejection, right, when you score 2 goals to bring it back to 3 each, and then they score another one. And, I mean, what do you do at that point, right?
We'll get to the goals one by one, basically, and it was just an absolute, difficult to describe other than just an absolutely amazing game of football with, as I said earlier, some absolutely fantastic finishing. But, I mean, the 5 minutes before halftime, I mean, 4 goals. Hugo Vieira has managed to score 2 goals within a minute, a literal minute, both goals registering in the 44th minute of play, and that's probably not the most amazing thing that happened in the game. I mean, Shonan's second goal from Shunsuke Kikuchi came from what I've been hearing is a typical Hiroki Ikura thing this season, where he's happy to get the dancing feet, and he's happy to advance outside his box, and it absolutely cost him in that regard. A fantastic first time finish from Shunsuke Kikuchi. But I'm getting ahead of myself, Sean. I'm getting a little bit carried away because that was the third goal of the game that came in the 28th minute. Before that, we had the own goal to get Shonan on the board in just the 8th minute. And I was glad to see this awarded as an own goal finally, because the DAZN commentator, you wouldn't have known this as you're in the stadium, of course, Sean, but the DAZN commentator wanted to give it to Stevanovic straight away, but basically he's crossed with the outside of his right foot. Yuji Nakazawa at close quarters simply reacted in the only way he could. He threw his head at it, but unfortunately he deflected it past Ikura. And inside the first 10 minutes, the easiest question I'll ask you all night, that's not the sort of start you wanted.
No, not at all. I think for as far as the commentator goes, I think I looked up at the screen and I think they did give it to him on the screen in the stadium. So maybe that changed later on in the game, but I remember I had it down as a hat-trick for two hat-tricks, one for each team, which was pretty amazing. But I think, yeah, as you said later, it was given as an own goal correctly against Nakazawa. And, I mean, not much you could do, but we keep saying all the goals, they're all our own doing, they're a bit unlucky. But, I mean, how many times can you be unlucky? I think at this point, there's probably questions to be asked about the defence. I mean, you lose four goals, right? You've got to ask questions, but I think every one of our goals were well worked, and the one you got to feel sorry for most is Hugo Vieira, because his goals were actually kind of, they weren't individual efforts actually. The first goal, I think it was the first goal, was a brilliant team effort, and it's been shared around Twitter for the last couple of days about how this is like a Pep Guardiola's wet dream, I think was the term used.
Right.
But it was a kind of, yeah, every player touched the ball, every player had the short pass, kind of triangles using, the ball goes into Hugo. He takes it, puts it through the defender's legs and scores, and it's a brilliant goal. And then, literally, just after that, Ikura, which actually, not even just this season, I think the past few seasons he's been known to think he's a bit of kind of Neuer and wander out the box and try and clear it. And, yeah, it's just undone everything that Hugo's tried to do. And you got to feel bad for him in that case, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, he scored an absolutely brilliant hat-trick, and at the end of the day, yeah, just a point for his side. But yes, you mentioned the goal there, Hugo's first of the afternoon in the 27th minute. And yes, I made it finally 17 passes, with the last one coming from Olivier Boumal into Vieira, turned his man a couple of touches and lashed into the far corner. But yes, just referencing Boumal and the Vieira, it obviously doesn't do the goal justice, does it? I mean, the ball came into Yokohama possession deep into your own half, and then, as I say, yeah, 17 passes later, and a crisp finish from Vieira, and it's in the back of the net. But I was going to ask you if you had actually gone and checked, because I did count the passes, but I wasn't able to make sure that everybody, every member of the team touched the ball. I thought there might maybe Yunil Lok maybe might not have, but you reckon that everybody did?
No, I think you're right, actually, because he's out on the other side, right? And the ball, when it eventually got into their half, I think it was a bit of a long ball over to Boumal, so probably it wouldn't have touched whoever was on the left wing. So, yeah, I think you're right on that. But Boumal, what a ball is there, yeah. He had a defender pressing him. He took it around him. He's been a great player so far, yeah. And he went off at half time. Don't know why, actually. Maybe a tactical change. Maybe he's tired, not fit yet. But, yeah, he's been a bit of a revelation so far, I think. So he scored last week as well. So been enjoying watching him.
Well, I was going to ask you about him going off, but again, we're getting ahead of ourselves, because there's still five more goals we've got to talk about that came after Vieira's first before we talk about, yeah, halftime substitutions, Sean. But, yeah, so basically Vieira's finished off this absolutely fantastic passing sequence with a, as I said, a brilliant finish, as we've both said, a fantastic strike. And then, again, from the highlights, I mean, the Hugo's goal goes in the 27th minute, and Kikuchi scores the goal I referenced earlier in the 28th. So can you tell me, was it literally Shonan kicked off and the ball was punted forward, or was there a few passes before that?
I didn't see the goal. I was still celebrating. Everybody was turned around. Honestly, I turned back and the ball was rolling towards the net. And it was one of those ones that you think it might hit the post and go out, but no, it just touched the side of the post and went in. And everyone was in shock, like, what happened?
Well, yeah, so from what I can gauge from the highlights, a ball was punted forward, so I'm not sure if it was exactly after Shonan kicked off or if they knocked it around for, you know, 10 seconds or so. But basically, yeah, Ikura has charged out of his box to the left of the goal. And if there happen to be any Yokohama supporters who are also Manchester City fans, and that's possible, I suppose, with the old CFG ownership group situation, well, they will have got to absolutely horrible flashbacks to a certain goal that Mohamed Salah scored for Liverpool against Man City in the 4-3 Liverpool win at Anfield earlier this season, where Edison charged out tried to clear the ball, and he basically played it straight to Salah's feet, who lobbed him from 45 yards. And as I said that, if there's any Man City supporting Yokohama fans, of course there is. It's hello to Frankie Correa. I'm sure Frankie will be well familiar with that Salah goal. And yes, this goal from Shunsuke Kikuchi, not quite a mirror image, but pretty much the same thing. As we've said, yeah, Ikura charged out, tried to clear the ball, but yeah, played it basically into a central area, straight to the feet of Kikuchi, who struck first time from, it must have been a similar range to the goal that Salah scored, I suppose, 40 yards, 45 yards. And, I think it's a great shot on the replay. One of the Shonan players in front of the goal actually thinks that the ball's going to hit the post and go out. I think he's got his hands on his head, but, it just kisses the inside of the post and settles into the net. So, as we've said, yeah, all the good work that Hugo Vieira did finishing off that amazing move basically was evaporated 30, 40 seconds later, and Shonan were back in front, Sean, and, as you say, you didn't see the goal live in the stadium. You were still jumping up and down. And it got even worse 4 minutes before half-time when Alan Stevanovic actually did score a goal that was credited to him, and rightly so. He was played in through the centre by Takuya Okamoto and a coolly slotted past Ikura, who might have got a touch on the ball with his boot, but yeah, wasn't able to divert it past the far post. And I guess this is sort of an encapsulation of the dangerous way that Yokohama defends, Sean. I mean, a high line, not a punt at all by Okamoto. It was a measured pass, a measured through ball, and Stevanovic was timing his run perfectly and was, basically had the last 20, 25, 30 yards to himself to run in and pick his spot past Ikura.
Yeah, I mean, that's a danger you have when you play this system, right? And I think last time I quoted Postecoglou talking about in his career, he's been playing this system however many years and however many games, and there was only one, or at least I think he said three times in however many hundred games that this has resulted in a goal against him. Mm. But to me, I count two in the last, 3 weeks that we've been scored against as a result of this, probably. So I think there has to be something done, and I think at half-time, actually, there was some changes. Maybe the wing-backs were pushed back a bit, and we defended a bit more tightly there, and it seemed to stop the kind of leaking of goals, right? But, yeah, I mean, that's the problem, right? I mean, if you score four goals, then you expect to win the match, and if you're losing four goals, two of which, to be honest, I mean, most of the goals against us, two of the goals against us were of our own doing. Whereas on the other side, I think all the goals we scored were, it was almost unstoppable, right, by Shonan. Well, I mean, you can't say too much about that. Their defending might also have been suspect, right, compared to other teams in the league.
Right.
But definitely two of their goals against us were completely avoidable and honestly things that should not happen and they should have been sorted in training. So I think people were displeased about that, and rightly so, to be honest. So I think something has to change in that respect. I don't know, I mean, it's not, I'm just not going to abandon the system as it is, so the defenders have to either get better at it or someone else has to play in that position. Then it is hard when you have two, honestly, not really mobile defenders. I mean, you've got Nakazawa, who's, I mean, he's still playing at that age, right, so what do you expect? And then you've got Deganek, who, I mean, he's good in there, scored the goal later on, getting ahead of herself again, but he's not the fastest off the mark, so a few times the ball's been played in behind him and he's taken a defender down, or taken the attacker down, and they've got a good free kick, or he's not caught up with them and they've got through, like, the second goal you talked about there. So yeah, something has to be done, I think, in the defence, and that's the major problem, right? So different from last season, we're leaking goals, so you can only say that these players don't match the system or they're not adapting well enough to it. So something has to change in that respect.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so that was Stevanovic's first goal of the afternoon in the 41st minute to make it 3-1. But then just 3 minutes later, it was 3-3 after Hugo Vieira finished off a first-half hat-trick with, as I mentioned earlier, two goals coming in exactly the 44th minute. And again, the marking was pretty ordinary. The Shonan defence happy to stand off Vieira after he took passes in from the left side of the box and basically was able to pick his spot. And in both occasions, he decided to poke home inside Yota Akimoto's left-hand post. And he finished with aplomb on both occasions. So just an absolute roller coaster of a first half, obviously, Sean. And, I mean, yeah, we will obviously come to the fact that Sean Unruh took the lead before half-time. But, I mean, that was it the same situation? You were still celebrating Vieira's goal to make it 3-2 as he made it 3-3?
Yeah. I mean, no, we were watching this time after what happened the first time.
Okay, fair enough.
It was unbelievable, yeah. And at that point, we really thought we'd go on and win the game. And, again, not to preempt you, but the fourth goal really... Honestly, people were laughing more than anything in the stadium because we couldn't believe our eyes what was happening here. And that's all good. We're all good at the time, but I think later on when you think back about that, we were laughing because it was so ridiculous and it's something that probably shouldn't have happened. So, yeah, if you put all that work into it and then you get back into it, then you kind of deserve to go on from that. But I think probably we took kind of an eye off the ball, if you want to put it that way. I think if you looked at Andrew, he was doing the kind of motioning to his head, kind of keep your head, keep calm sort of thing. And no, I don't think the players did. I think they didn't know what to do when we went up again. And that's the thing about the system, where when it's 0-0 or 3-3 or something like that, kind of the other team kind of sit in. They sit in to an extent, but they have to play forward, right? They have to attack and they have to try and get a goal to win. But when we go ahead, they either have to attack us or they have to keep playing the same way they are, right? So what I notice is whenever we go a goal ahead, we don't really know what to do. We've been obviously practicing and training, breaking down these tight defences. We've got all the possession. But when a team, they just put so much pressure on us, it starts to leak at the back and you can see that we're not comfortable with that. And on the other hand, when we're chasing a goal and the other team are just sitting in, then we don't have the creativity to get balls into the box. We're kind of just punting balls into the middle and hoping someone gets on the head. I mean, that's how we scored actually from Deganek in the second half. It was a corner, right? So
yeah.
Was that a corner? Yeah, corner, right?
Yeah.
So we didn't look like scoring. Apart from that, I mean, there was a few near misses, right? But we weren't that dangerous. We had all the possession. We had all the chances. But we didn't look that threatening. They looked comfortable defending against us. And even when we went 4-4, they were just kind of hard to break down, right? And that's Shonan's defence. So if you can't break down Shonan's defence, you're not going to break down Kashima's defence next week, right? It's just not going to happen. So there needs to be more creativity there somewhere, and maybe that needs a new player. I mean, we've got possible Brazilian player on the way in the summer window by the looks of things, so maybe something like that is what's needed.
Fair enough there. Well, you're great with bringing the scoops on New Yokohama signings on the podcast. Absolutely fantastic. Of course, you were the first to tell me about Olivier Boumal coming in, and he was basically straight in the team, I think, the next week, wasn't he? After you'd mentioned him on the podcast, and then, okay, a new Brazilian in the summer. All right, terrific. I'll look forward to that, and hopefully he'll have as positive an impact as Boumal has. Oh, so yeah, you mentioned earlier that he went off at half time. That was, of course, after Stevanovic had made it 4-3 to Shonan in the first minute of a first half stoppage time. Similar to Vieira's quick fire double to finish off his hat trick, Stevanovic fired in basically in the same spot of the goal as his first just 4 or 5 minutes earlier. So both of the foreign strikers picked their spots and liked it so much the first time they doubled up their fun. And so we can talk a little bit about Boumal and his impact now, if you like, Sean, because as I said, you told me that he was coming in. He came straight in and he's basically started every league game since. He was we presume sacrificed for tactical reasons at half time, but with that aside, how impressed, how happy have you been with him so far? With him, basically, as we've said, coming straight into the club and straight into the team.
Yeah, he's a good player, I think. Like you said, substituted tactically, probably. So, I mean, it seems that he is a luxury in that. I don't know, maybe he doesn't track back as much as the other players. He tries to, but maybe his fitness levels aren't there yet or something like that. But he does seem to be the one to get hooked when we do make a change. So, yeah, whether that's up to fitness or not, we'll see in the next few games. But, yeah, he's got probably saw in the goal, the first goal that Hugo scored, that he has the kind of, he's got a physical presence that is good for the league because a lot of players don't have that. I mean, to be honest, it was kind of bad pressing on him, actually. He shouldn't have been allowed to get around so easily like that, but he does it time and time again. And I think, I don't know if it was last week, but, when he scored the goal, yeah, it was the last week there. I think probably the other striker, Ito Sho at the time, I think, Sho Ito, he almost kind of stood off the ball and the defenders expected him to be past it, but Bumal kept the ball and he kind of pushed through this wall of men and he made it past two defenders. And he does that. He kind of runs into men and beats them. And that's the player that's the kind of player we didn't have before. And it's really changed the way that we play, which is good because we really need to get balls into the box. And there's no one else that can do that except from him, to be honest, right now.
All right then, terrific stuff. So, as I said, great to see him having such a good impact straight away. One of the other foreigners for Yokohama, Miloš Deganek, made it 4-4 on the afternoon, 12 minutes into the second half. We've briefly referenced the goal he headed in after Ryosuke Yamanaka headed on Jun Amano's corner. And 4-4, and well, I've got to ask you, Sean, what were the teams up to for the last half hour? I mean, they spent all their pennies scoring four goals each in the first hour, and they had no ammunition left, or were there decent chances for both teams to win it? Or, you know, it's a bit of an anticlimax, really, when you see eight goals in the first hour and then none in the last 30 minutes.
Yeah, we had enough chances to win it, actually. We brought on, when Bumar went off, we brought on another striker, actually. And well, he's kind of a striker, I guess, and put him on the right-hand side there. And I think probably because of that, we had more attacking focus and we had all the pressure was on them, and they defended well, to be fair, I think. But we had a few chances that, you know, on another day, it would have went in. I think one of them went right past the post, one of them went over the bar, and maybe I think might have hit the bar at some point or made a few good saves. But yeah, I think, to be honest, we were a bit unlucky in the second half, but the second half was more, it was very similar to the Kawasaki game second half, where, I mean, we got a goal, but we could have had more, and we should have had more, actually. And that's where the problem lies, right? In that kind of situation, when we're breaking down, have to break down a team and get a goal, that we're not doing that. And that was a more typical Mariners game, if you want to put it that way, 1-0, struggling to get another goal. And if you're playing against Hiroshima, for example, we played against the other week, then, yeah, it's not going to cut it. You may get one goal, but they'll get three on the counter, because if you're putting so much pressure on them, but you're not taking chances, then you're leaving yourself open for all that time as well, for a good countering team to make an effort at you. And, yeah, maybe Shonan, I mean, that's why they're there on the table, right? They don't have quite that skill, but a team further up the table, they'll pick you apart when you do that, so yeah, that's something that we need to start scoring in that position, or we need to start defending better. Well, ideally both, but you can't really do both with that system. So ideally we have to start scoring goals.
Absolutely. All right. Yeah, I want to get your thoughts on Hiroshima in a little bit more detail in just a minute. But yeah, I mean, bigger picture. So I mean, yeah, this was the game of the season so far for mine, and I imagine everybody who was there would absolutely second that. And yeah, while there are certainly question marks about a lot of the defending, I mean, you can't argue with some of the strikes that were absolutely terrific. But yeah, basically, we had you on the first time you made your J-Talk debut, Sean, after the 1-0 away win over Urawa in match day 4. You followed that up with another 1-0 away win over Shimizu the next weekend, but they remain your two league wins of the season so far. Of course, after that, you played out a fascinating Kanagawa derby with Kawasaki that finished 1-1, and then, yeah, two straight losses before Saturday's 4-4 draw. So Well, we've spoken about the defending at length. Obviously, the team, the attack is, well, certainly as far as Hugo Vieira is concerned, firing on fairly healthy cylinders at the moment. But, yeah, as you say, that the balance is very difficult to strike. I mean, you're sensing, I know you're saying people were laughing after Shilner was scoring their fourth goal. You just couldn't believe what you're seeing. But is there do you think there's a growing sense of frustration with the results? Or, I mean, is the entertainment value of the football just too enticing?
No, I mean, I think if we'd lost, it would have been bad. I think the week before as well, if we'd lost that game, it would have also been... the fans would have started to turn, I think. I mean, we're still in kind of the honeymoon period, if you want to put it that way, of the manager. So, I mean, he's got time. He needs time. He won't get time, but he needs time to implement what he wants to do and bring in the summer, if he wants to bring in Marcus Jr., by the way, is the player I was talking about. Apparently made a bid for it. I'm not sure which team actually. Flamengo is at the Brazilian league. And, he needs time to implement that kind of thing, I think. But, yeah, I think if you have a decent run and maybe we're mid table or kind of pushing towards the top, then people would say fair enough. But if you're in relegation zone, then, which we're just out of, then it starts to become kind of get the results now, right? So, I think if things continue going just as they are, with draws in games like that and a win now and again, then we're kind of okay and Ange has the time to try and do what he's done. But if we start losing some more games, and 9 from 9 is already a pretty bad record, but if it gets worse than that, then I think the manager probably will feel the pressure as well more than anyone. And something we'll have to give at some point. So I listened to, I don't know if it was last week, was it Scott that was on? And I think you had a chat with him.
Yep.
Yeah, about his thoughts on Ange. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I noticed, you'd be more informed than me, but when I see on Twitter people posting things in English about Marinos and Ange, and the Australian kind of fans' comments on those Twitter accounts, it's usually very divided, right? It's like, oh yeah, this is exactly the kind of football I'm expecting from him. And they mean that in both that they scored 4 goals, scored some amazing goals, and lost 4 goals as well, right? I know his opinion's always been divided on him. And I realise why now, right? He's a kind of divisive figure. But I think he still has a full backing of the fans. I think the club in general will start to take some heat if we lose another game. Really need to at least put up a fight against Sapporo tomorrow, right?
So that's right.
If that doesn't go well, then the next home game, if we lose that, then I think people will be very upset. Probably then, who knows what will happen from there?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a full round of J1 on Wednesday night, and obviously we'll come to the fixtures later on. You might even be listening to this podcast on the way to a game, so if you are, I hope you enjoy the podcast firstly, and I hope your team wins on Wednesday evening. But yes, basically we've got 6 games left before the World Cup break, Sean, so the league obviously takes a break after the 15th round of games. Before then, Yokohama play 4 of the 6 at home. And it doesn't look a particularly difficult fixture list, apart from, Sapporo, who are flying high in fourth, of course. They're the highest team you have to face. Iwata just crept into the bottom end of the top half with a win in match day 9. And apart from that, everybody else you'll be playing are in the bottom half of the table, including the current bottom two of Gumba and Nagoya. Mind you, Gumba have looked slightly better in the last 2 or 3 rounds. I mentioned there's 6 games left, but principally because that 4 of those will be played at home at the Nissan Stadium. And I want to ask you, with the way that you set up and the way that teams are happy to sit back for the most part against you, is that actually a disadvantage, do you think? Do you think you're better off playing on the road? I mean, that's probably fairly basic analysis on my part, the fact that your two wins this season have both come on the road. But do you think that teams are more content to sit back and soak up pressure when they're playing on your patch rather than if, you know, there's some sort of expectations from their home crowd that, you know, they should, they should want the ball and should want to attack when they're playing in front of their own fans?
No, I think you're right about that. It's probably, I mean, the home team has a bit of pressure to attack, right? The fans will get on their back. So that suits us. I mean, we want the teams to move out of the pack defence. But at the same time, there's been teams that have attacked us at home as well. I think, was it Tosu, actually, when they played us at Mitazawa? I mean, not Nissan, but Mitazawa. They were flying out of the gates. In the end, we had, what, 70% possession, as you'd expect. But I think they were quite open and willing to play football. So, I mean, not necessarily the case. If a team, I think if they think they can bring the game to us, and if that's the way they play, then they'll do it. But, I think at Nissan, yeah, especially, you're right, that probably the tendency is that teams will sit in against us. And if we can break that down, then, yeah, we're kind of at a loss. I mean, that's the problem we had last season as well, to an extent. It's not just with the way we're playing now, that We had a lot of possession, but not a lot of goals, actually. Or not a lot of the creativity to make goals there. And Manabu Saito, I think he was kind of off the boil. He didn't score the whole season. Maybe he scored one goal, I think. And he was kind of a creative player before then, right? He would drive into the box and make things happen. But losing him, and anyway, it wasn't a loss if you think of it that way. But we don't have another player that really does that. We've got Jun Amino, but it's not the same type of player. And Bumal, who's shaking things up a bit, hopefully he can do something. But I think, yeah, when we've got a packed defence we're playing against, you feel bad for Hugo because he's not getting any service, and you can tell that maybe his head was down, he's been making these runs and he doesn't get the ball in. Or eventually it's just a whipped ball in that the defenders are about 2 feet taller than him can just head away, and that's been the story of the season so far. So I think probably if we're going to do anything, we have to sort the home form, and that's only going to be done if we can, yeah, we can start scoring goals against packed defences. And that needs a creative player, needs kind of a bit of spark and a bit of creativity. But yeah, I don't see where that's coming from yet.
All right, then. So before we move on to Hiroshima, you mentioned Judas Saito there. So I have to ask you your thoughts, your feelings, Sean, when Manabu Saito came off the bench for Kawasaki Frontale against Yokohama F. Marinos. I bet you never had to thought you'd have to contemplate hearing those words, but he did so for the last 13 minutes of the Kanagawa Derby. Your thoughts, your feelings, was your blood boiling over? Talk us through that period.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun, actually. I mean, I don't know if you saw the J-League put up this video of kind of behind the scenes of all the matches. They do one a week, I think, and there's one for that one, the Kanagawa Derby. I really recommend anybody watches it because it has that moment when he walks out onto the field. But it has him when they announce him as a substitute, and then when he comes on, and you can just hear the kind of the roar of boos coming from the Mariners supporters. And it's funny, I was talking to a few people after the game, and even people who they were saying they're still fans of his, and they support him and hope he does well. But something changed in that moment and just made them kind of click and hate this guy for the next 30 minutes. So
right.
Yeah, every time he touched the ball, it was just a crowd of like fun there. And thankfully he didn't score. He didn't do too well actually in that game. So and at the end actually he came over. He was going to try and kind of, I guess, come over to our fans and kind of say hello, but someone stopped him. I think one of the players stopped him and told him not to. There was kind of a ring of boos when he was walking towards, and then someone stopped him and told him, "Nah, maybe you better not do that." So,
right.
It was a good kind of pantomime, like theater kind of laugh. I think you can't take that too serious, and I'm sure he knew it was coming. So, he got the reception maybe he deserved, but it would have been the kind of classic football drama if he'd scored the winning goal or something in that match, right? So
sure.
That's the one thing I was hoping didn't happen, and luckily it didn't, so we could have won, but yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, yes, it must have been, well, strange as an absolute understatement to, yeah, to see your former captain rock up in your, well, one of your biggest rivals, kit. But, yes, you lived that in the Kanagawa Derby in match day six. And in the following round, Sean, Yokohama travelled to Hiroshima and were undone 3-1. The previously mentioned Scott McIntyre is certainly not a wrap for the way Hiroshima set up or the way they go about things, but it's a results business, and they find themselves an astonishing 9 points clear at the top of the J1 table after nine match days. They are, well, it goes without saying, the only unbeaten team left. Everybody else has lost at least twice, of course. They opened the season with three wins. They led up for a week and had a draw, and since then they've peeled off five straight wins. They've conceded just two goals in their nine games. Now, they have not set the world on fire in terms of scoring goals. They've only scored 12 in the nine games, but yeah, three of those happened to come against Yokohama at the Edion Stadium, and a double from Patrick. So, what can you put your finger on? How did they beat you on that particular night, Sean? What did you see from them? And well, I'm not asking you if you think they deserve to be top, because clearly they do. Nobody can beat them. But yeah, do you think you discovered a little bit of the secret to their success on that evening, or that particular loss?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of get it. I get why they're top, and it's like. It's ugly football, right? The what they play, but it works, and that's what matters to them, right? And in the end, that's what decides who's going to win the league, right? So, I mean, we had an insane amount of possession. I think it was over 80% in the first half, and we're 1-0 up. So you think you're going to win this game? And I mean, we needed a penalty to score, right? But I think we looked like we were in control. It didn't look like they were dangerous. They were playing their standard style, right? Sitting back and countering, and it wasn't working for them, I think, and I thought, I don't get it. I don't get the hype about them. Why is this good? And then they scored three goals.
Right.
And it was Patrick. Patrick does it as well, right? He's just a machine, I think, right? For some reason. I mean, that's all they need to do. That's literally the entire game plan, right? Get the ball to him when there's not much of the opposition player in their half, and then he'll do something, and you get a goal. And it's as simple as that, and it works. And yeah, I got a goal there, right? I don't know if he got two. I think it was one he got.
No, it was two, yeah.
It wasn't two, yeah. So he's got those goals. And I think he's second on the top goal scorers now. Hugo Vieira is first.
He is on seven goals. I did mention that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, seven for the season for Hugo. Fantastic stuff. But yeah, Patrick does have six. That's right.
Yeah, that's all right. I mean, he got three in that game in the weekend. If you ignore that, then Patrick's right up there, right? And he's their talisman, right? And he came on as a sub, and I think that might have changed it, right? It might have swung it a bit in that game. So, yeah, I don't see how you beat them. I mean, unless you score so many goals that they can't counter, I think it'll work. There's not a team good enough to beat them at their own game, I think. And you can't be naive against them. I think maybe that's the thing about, for example, our system, where we have this system, right, and you play it against every team, and it doesn't matter who you're playing against Shonan, you're playing against Gamba at the bottom, you're playing against Hiroshima at the top, you play that system, and yeah, is that really football management? I don't know. I mean, I think you got to have a plan B in that case, and probably when you play against Hiroshima, you got to set up to neutralise. I mean, I'm sure the teams do that, but you got to be on the ball, and you got to make sure you can't let these guys get the ball at all, even if it means like a professional foul getting a yellow card. You can't let them run against you, and I think that's what happened to us. I think it may have been Deganic, in fact, out in the wing, just kind of get ragdolled, and I think it was Patrick's speed just took him by surprise, and at that point probably just kick him. That's what I was thinking,
right.
Just get him down. But no, if you don't do that, then he'll run riot, I think, and that's the secret to their success. Not so secret. I don't know why it hasn't worked until now, but that's as simple as it is. And yeah, I mean, there's a big gap now, right? I don't know how many points it is.
Yeah, 9 points.
Right, 9 points. And I noticed that 9 points, if you count the team that's second and Gamba last, is it Gamba that's last? Yeah. Then
Gamba and Nagoya, yeah, joint bottom. Yeah, Nagoya have a worse goal difference, yeah.
Oh, okay, right. So if you count the points between second and last place, it's the same. It's 9 points. I don't know if that's changed.
No, that is correct. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, right. So it kind of shows how ridiculous it is and how far they are in front. And yeah, who's going to stop them, right? Unless the break might actually be bad for them. Teams that are kind of in stuttering form like us, we might be able to do something over the break and it might can disrupt them a bit. But yeah, it's hard to see past them for the title, even this early.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my club, FC Tokyo, will be the next cab off the rank to have a shot at knocking Hiroshima off on a Wednesday night when the two teams clash at Ajinomoto Stadium. And it's actually a clash of the top two in J1. I mean, you could have written your own ticket on this fixture in match day 10 being a clash of the top two after Hiroshima, of course, narrowly avoided relegation last year and FC Tokyo did their normal mid-table finish routine. But they both won 1-0 last weekend. Hiroshima 1-0 at home over Tosu, thanks to that man, Patrick, his sixth goal of the season, 7 minutes from time. Well, Tokyo also won 1-0 away at Shimizu. Yokohama, we've followed Yokohama's lead by winning 1-0 away at S-Pol. Sean, a Kensuke Nagai goal in the 59th minute was the only goal of the game for Tokyo. So, it'll be an interesting game. I'm not optimistic, as I, of course, never am with Tokyo, but it'll be really interesting to see, firsthand how Hiroshima go about things. I'm not sure it'll be the most entertaining game because while Tokyo are second, they have certainly not set the world on fire in terms of free-flowing attacking football, apart from, you could argue, the 5-2 win over Nagasaki. But yes, as I say, the clash of the top two, and who would have thunk it? It's very much still a topsy-turvy, upside-down table for the most part in J1. And yeah, Hiroshima and Tokyo being at the top is the perfect indication of that. Tokyo actually moved up to second from fifth in the table. Another big mover in match day 9 was Kawasaki, the previously mentioned Frontale. They turned on the style, winning 4-1 at home rather over Kashima. An own goal gave them the lead in just the fifth minute. Eduardo Neto scored the second 2 minutes into the second half. Ryota Nagaki deflected free kick, reduced Kashima's arrears just past the hour mark, but literally a minute later, Kengo Nakamura poked a dreadfully underhit back pass from young fullback Itsuki Oda through the Kashima keeper's legs to restore Kawasaki's two-goal cushion, and then Yoshida Okubo finished off things in the 81st minute, by which time Kashima were down to 10 men after Gen Shoji was sent off and shown a second yellow card. So we've mentioned the reception that Manabu Saito got in the Kanagawa Derby, Sean. What did you make of Kawasaki on the day? They've certainly not hit too many heights so far this season, but an emphatic return to form against the Antlers, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, just going from the game against us, in the first half, they could have scored five goals. We could have been 5-0 down. And to be honest, I think they hit the bar. They hit the bar, maybe hit the post as well. We made a good save, but it was just by. Or they were offside. Maybe it was wrongly ruled offside. But I think, honestly, they should have been 4 or 5 goals up against us. And they're a dangerous team. I don't know what happened in the second half, actually, that we took control. But maybe they were kind of settled with what they had, or maybe we changed something. But yeah, they look like a team that can score a lot of goals, and like they did against Kashima there. But I mean, it's hard to measure that Kashima side. I mean, I know there's a lot of injuries still, but they don't look good so far. They don't look quite like title contenders, I think. But Kawasaki, they did a good job against them. And it was quite a heated game, I think. It looked like a kind of top two clash in terms of the personalities, right? I think there was a yellow card. I don't know which Kawasaki player it was, but I'm sure he basically elbows a guy in the chest in front of the the referee. I can't remember which player
that would be. Akihiro Iyanaga on. Yuma Suzuki. Yes, that's right.
Right. Which is interesting because I think Suzuki at the start was kind of friendly with the Kawasaki players. They all looked like they were having a good time, but when it got to that point, it looked like it was going to kick off. So yeah, it was a heated game, but Kawasaki deservedly top on that one.
Absolutely. All right. We mentioned Sapporo briefly before. They stayed fourth in the table after a 0-0 draw away at Reds in the Misha Petrovic Derby. A healthy crowd of over 39,000, but unfortunately no goals on the afternoon to speak of at Saitama Stadium. Sadezo Osaka and Vegalta Sendai both dropped down the table, allowing Tokyo and Frontale to move up above Sapporo. Well, Sadezo and Vegalta moved down below them after losses in match day 9. Sadezo losing the Osaka Derby 1-0 away at Gunba Osaka. And speaking of healthy crowds, over 35,000 at the Suita City Stadium to see Huang Wei Zhou convert from the penalty spot in the 41st minute after he drew a penalty, a foul from Mate Jonjic. Just 4 minutes from halftime, Huang's penalty went in under Kim Jin-hyun, who might like to have that spot kick back. He almost saved it, but was unable to keep it out. A fierce low drive from Huang just did enough to find the net, while Vegalta's obviously made a very promising start to the season, but they were absolutely thumped 3-0 at home by Jubilo Iwata, and three pretty good goals too, it must be said, from Iwata. Takuya Matsuya, 11 minutes into the second half, just 2 minutes later, a brilliant Daiki Ogawa goal, a cut in from the right, drove untouched, dribble with the ball 25, 30 yards, and then from a 25 yards out, lashed a shot into the top corner at the keeper's near post, and then a Taishi Taguchi glanced in a header from a Shunsuke Nakamura free kick 8 minutes from time. So as I think I said earlier, Iwata crept in to the bottom half the bottom half of the top half of the table with, I haven't explained that well at all, but they're up to eighth, Jubilo, I should have just said that, from the start. Very briefly, the other results from the match day. Kobe matched Iwata's 3-0 win with a 3-0 home win over hapless Nagoya. That's six straight losses in the league for Grampus, and I can't keep track, including the Levain Cup. It must be eight or nine now. Nagoya are now rock bottom, a goal difference below Gunba Osaka. Kobe scoring some good goals themselves. Jungwoo Young in the 12th minute, and then a brace from Lucas Podolski, which was great to see. Two excellent goals, the first 6 minutes into the second half, and then his second 9 minutes from time. And the last game of the match that was played on Sunday, and Nagasaki, plucky little Nagasaki, I'm going to have to stop calling them that because they've won three straight games now. And yes, they're all the way up to 11th. They defeated Kashiwa Reysol 1-0 at home. Shu Hiramatsu heading down and past Kosuke Nakamura, a free kick from Shogo Nakahara. So terrific stuff from V. Varen. And Sean, that's pretty much all we can do as far as reviewing match day 9. As we both said earlier, there's a full round of games in J1 on Wednesday. For Yokohama, that means a trip up to Sapporo. Unfortunately, not the Sapporo Dome, though. The game's been played at Consadole's second stadium at Atsubetsu, but that'll be a nice trip up for the F Marinos faithful. Are you able to get time off work to go up and see that game, Sean?
No, I wanted to go until... I mean, that's two things that are wrong with it. It's on a Wednesday night, and the second one is that it's at Tsubetsu, right? Not at Sapporo, which, I mean, everyone wants to go see, sure. Right? So that's disappointing. And we've got Nagasaki in November, like nearly the last match. So the two good trips this year, yeah, they're out the window, but I'll maybe go see that with my coat on. But no, I'll be watching it in the pub, I think. So hopefully we can get a result. And but it's going to be tough. I mean, they're good and they're in form, so we'll see what happens.
Absolutely. And then on Saturday in match day 11, you host Kashima Antlers, who obviously will be, well, I would say smarting after the loss to Kawasaki, but then, of course, we don't know what they're going to do on Wednesday at home against Kobe. But, yeah, always, it goes without saying, a dangerous opponent, Antlers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a night game as well. Is it the first Saturday night game of the season? So looking forward to that, actually. It's always good. And I think, yeah, it's not going to be easy, but who knows? I mean, we're both kind of in not so great form, so it could go either way.
Indeed, indeed. All right, so yeah, briefly on Wednesday, we've mentioned the clash of the top two with the leaders Hiroshima travelling to Tokyo to face second-placed FC Tokyo. Obviously, it's a 7 o'clock kickoff. All the games on Wednesday night kick off at 7 p.m. Another notable game is a clash between Cerezo Osaka and Sendai, the previously mentioned two teams who slipped out of the top three after match day 9. They clash at the Kincho Stadium in Osaka, and yeah, a small quirk of the schedule that FC Tokyo play home on both Wednesday and Saturday, and Nagoya are their visitors on Saturday afternoon, while Iwata do the same. They host Nagasaki on Wednesday night before then fronting up with the visit of Cerezo Osaka, while Hiroshima are on the road for two games, Tokyo and Nagasaki, as are Kawasaki Frontale. They play at Tosu on Wednesday and then Kobe on the Saturday. And by the way, in match day 11, there are 8 games on the Saturday, just the one on Sunday. That's Gunma Osaka hosting Tosu at 4 p.m. I won't run through each fixture one by one, but yes, if you listen to this after Wednesday and you want to get to a game on the weekend, well, you've still got time to check the J-League website and make your plans. All right, Sean, well, that's been absolutely brilliant to get another update on Yokohama, how they've got on through 9 games, and in particular, of course, the game against Shonan. Glad to hear your heart rate has returned to a sense of normality. And, yes, I hope to speak to you again soon, mate.
Yeah, heart rate back to normal until tomorrow night, right? But, yeah, it's been great to be back on. And, yeah, hopefully next time I'll have a kind of more positive news to speak about as far as Mariners go.
Absolutely. And on Twitter, it's at 1am Sage. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's the one, I think. I think I did get quite a good bump from last time, yeah? So thanks for that. And, yeah, anyone else, please follow. I'll try and not be too boring.
Well, that's absolutely terrific to hear. Good to hear you got the J-Talk bump. That's fantastic. So thanks again to Sean Galbraith. I'll be back in a moment with John Steele. I'm hoping to run another monthly J2 special with Stuart Smith and John Steele as part of next week's podcast. Hi, Stuart, if you're listening. I'll be in touch soon. But ahead of that, John has popped in to fill us in on the week's goings-on in the second tier. John, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me back. Yeah, very well. And I'm sure Stuart is listening. I don't think he has anything else to do in his evenings. I'm sure he's there somewhere. Hi, Stuart. Perhaps talk to you next week.
Indeed. Certainly hope to do just that. Yes, Stuart's probably listening to see how long we'll discuss Ruaso Kumamoto for on this week's episode. John, he has set the over-under at 25 minutes, and I would put a lot of money on the under. But we will be discussing Ruaso Kumamoto on this week's episode. Well, we'll come back to that later. We're going to lead off our J2 wrap, John, with the game that you were at on Saturday. Mito had made a strong start to the season, and after a wobble, they had won their last game at home against Kanazawa to steady their ship, but they were swept aside at Nishigaoka by Tokyo Verde. The Greens cruising to a 3-0 win over 10-man Hollyhock.
Yeah, and it was a nice day to be at a football stadium. As I'm sure the listeners know, there was kind of a mini heat wave across much of Japan at the weekend. It was about 25, 26 degrees. And yeah, Mito just seemed to... They made an okay start in the first 5 minutes, and they could have scored from a kind of goal-mouth scramble where the ball was pinballing all around the Verde penalty area. But yeah, after that, the game was even for about 10 minutes, and then yeah, Verde got the first goal in the 10th minute when Shinosuke Hatanaka scored from a corner, and yeah, from then on, Verde were pretty much in control, and they didn't really look like relinquishing that lead. And 10 minutes into the second half, former Verdi man Ryoji Fukui picked up his second yellow card. So he was off, and then Douglas Vieira and Alan Pinheiro took full advantage with very well taken goals. And yeah, Verdi stay unbeaten, and in the end it was pretty comfortable.
Yeah, terrific! Three terrific goals from the Greens, and yeah, unbeaten. They also kept a fifth straight clean sheet. So yeah, good to see them doing so well going forward. As you said, yeah, the goals from Vieira and Pinheiro were terrific in particular. But yes, the defence is becoming a hallmark of this Verdi team. They've let in just three goals in the 10 games so far. That's a joint best in the league with Okoyama.
Yeah, I think this is something I'm in danger of repeating myself numerous times, but it's obviously something that the players and the coach Miguel Lotina work on very carefully. I think they tend to play now. They have a three-man defence. It's Hatanaka who scored the opening goal on Saturday, and Akira Ibayashi, the captain, and then Tomohiro Taira is the other one of the three centre backs. So perhaps individually he might be the weakest of the three, but they've formed a really kind of cohesive unit. I would mention as well, just in front of them, they have a Tatsuya Uchida, who does a great job of kind of screening the back three and kind of breaking up the play when necessary. I think Mito were really, they looked a bit light in central midfield on Saturday, and he had a field day sort of breaking up a lot of their moves. But yeah, I think you can really see, I mean, it's true with a lot of the J2 teams. If you look at the squads on paper, you've got no idea which team is stronger than the other, but you can really see the difference that good coaching makes. And yeah, something that I often criticise the Japanese teams for is game management. They don't seem to be ready for particular circumstances during a game, but I don't think that's a criticism you could level at Tokyo Verdy this year. I am biased because I watch them a lot. It's one of the closest teams to me, and some of the cheapest tickets around, so I end up there quite often.
Right.
But yeah, you don't manage to go 10 games unbeaten without doing something right. So I think they can be justifiably pleased with their start. And yeah, I urge anybody, if you haven't checked out the goals from the Mito game on Saturday, Alan Pinheiro's goal in particular is a sumptuous chip. Yeah, you could be watching Mohamed Salah if you squint a little bit.
Absolutely, yeah, terrific. I was thinking more Roberto Firmino, John Papp, especially with the Pinheiro's dodgy hairstyle. But yes, terrific goal to finish off the scoring in the 90th minute. Now, John, when I saw that you were going to this game on Twitter, you tweeted about it on Saturday, I thought, well, this might be a good opportunity to have a bit of a chat about Mito, because, of course, as I said, they made a strong start to the season. I think they were unbeaten in their first four. They had a bit of a dip, but yeah, I mean, they came into the game in the top half of the table, and fair enough too, but yeah, I guess this just wasn't the right day to watch Mito or to be asking you about Mito.
Yeah, I think we have to cut them a little bit of slack and say that when you play, you know, they had a man sent off after 55 minutes. The game was still in the balance at 1-0 at that point. So to play for 35 minutes plus in that heat, it was really hot at the stadium. So I think I tweeted that the players just seem to kind of wilt in the heat, and I think it's almost understandable. It's not that they down tools, but I think they just seem to run out of energy, and they couldn't match. They couldn't seem to get anything going against, as we mentioned, a very well drilled Verdi team. I did have a good look though, because I hadn't seen Mito much this season before the game, so I just looked at their kind of starting lineup from the last couple of games and compared it to what they started with on Saturday. I think what I picked up on is they probably have a pretty strong first 11 that's got them a good start to the season, but I didn't really see anything outside of that first kind of 11 or 13 players that looked to give them any strength in depth. So I think it might be a case that if those 11 or 12 players who are kind of first team regulars, if they're all fit and if they're all in form, I think Mito can give teams a lot of problems. But I'm a bit worried that they don't have much in reserve. So when some of those first teamers have a dip in form, any players of a similar calibre who can come in come in and replace them. So I think they have made a good start, and they're rubbing my nose in the brown stuff, because I thought they'd perhaps be in relegation trouble. It looks like they're probably too strong, too good to have any problems at the wrong end of the table. But no, for me, not really enough quality. Although they did have some nice passing moves, it didn't really amount to much in the end. So yeah, it was a bad day at the office for them. Actually, they've only won, I think, one of the last five now. So after having a very kind of nosebleed start, I think they might just be reverting to type a little bit. They might slide down the table a little bit more, I think, and end up in probably the right position for them, based on what I've seen, is probably about mid-table. And I think we might see them end up there. Maybe after Golden Week, you know, we're entering the period where the J2 teams will play three games in a week. And, yeah, perhaps then they're usually around the end of Golden Week is when the table starts to take on a kind of more, you know, medium-term complexion. So perhaps we'll see them in mid-table by the end of Golden Week.
All right, fair enough then. So, yeah, it sounds like a very pleasant afternoon at Nishigaoka in, suburban Tokyo. I've never been, John, actually. So what can you tell us briefly about the ground? I mean, obviously it's a very compact little stadium. Is that the sort of ground that Verdy should be playing in, week out? I mean, they obviously, you know, they don't get more than 4,000 or 5,000 to most of their home games at Ajinomoto Stadium, which holds 50,000. I mean, there were, 3,700 there on Saturday. I mean, they obviously want to aim higher than playing in before 3,700 fans every week, but is that kind of where they're at as a club at the moment?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Something that I always enjoy is, I mean, you go to Ajinomoto a lot to watch the other side, you know, from the capital, if you like, FC Tokyo. And I know it's a different experience when there's sort of 25,000 or 30,000 people, but I think we can agree that it's not a particularly good football stadium. You know, the seats are really far away from the pitch. It's a very cavernous bowl.
Well, yeah, it's not a football stadium, is it?
It's not a football stadium. Yeah, even though its official name is Tokyo Soccer Stadium, it's not really an appropriate one. So yeah, Ajinomoto Stadium is, I don't think, it's one of those stadiums that seems like it's been designed by people that didn't really understand what a football stadium should look like or what kind of purpose it should serve. I mean, I read that I think FC Tokyo are trying to angle in to move to the national stadium, aren't they, after that's finished.
Sure, or build their own stadium in Yuyuki Park.
Yeah, so I think there's even a recognition that even if you can get Ajinomoto Stadium sort of mostly full, it's still not a great place to play. So yeah, it's pretty desperate and sad sometimes when you go there and watch Tokyo Verdy and sort of 47,000 of these grey seats are empty. I think making the seats grey was probably a bad idea as well. But we're off topic. But yeah, Nishigaoka's a funny one because it basically serves it's linked to the Japan Sports Council's sort of training centre. A lot of Japanese Olympic athletes actually train in and around there because it's kind of connected to Ajinomoto. They also, it's a food processing company in Japan, quite a big one for anyone who doesn't know Ajinomoto. And yeah, they sponsor or they pay to kind of, they have the naming rights for the national sort of Olympic training centre there, as well as the nowadays the soccer stadium too. So yeah, it's a good place to watch a game. I think it would be good for Verdy to have something of that size, possibly slightly bigger, you know, in case they do ever attract extra fans or for when Matsumoto Yamaga are in town.
Right.
I think the issue with Nishigaoka being used as a more permanent venue is it doesn't meet any of the J-League criteria to be a club's home stadium. So any team that wants to play a J-League game at Nishigaoka has to have like a kind of special permission. Mm-hmm. To play there. It doesn't have enough seats or covered seats, and even I think there's a rule that the seats have to have like a number, like a kind of, you know, a row.
Oh, yeah.
Like a row and number, and at the backstand certainly, you know, along the side of the pitch in Nishigaoka doesn't have any numbers on the seats, and I think the both ends behind the goal are terraced. There's no seats at all. It's a nice place to watch a game as a diversion. I think maybe with some renovation it could be a good base for Verdy. I think it's probably a topic we should dive into another time in detail, but it's obviously, you'd only have to go to one Verdy home game at Ajinomoto to see that that's not a sustainable operation. And I think if FC Tokyo end up leaving Ajinomoto and Verdi are left as kind of the sole tenants, I'm not really sure if that stadium is viable in its current form. Yeah. They might have to get some serious kind of... give some serious consideration to maybe doing something different with that whole site, you know.
Right.
So we're perhaps talking long term, but I think one of the things I like, and Verdi usually play one or two home games a season away from Ajinomoto for whatever reason. And you can actually sense when you go to the game, fans are just really looking forward to being a bit closer to the pitch. Seeing the players close up and maybe having a kind of closer bond during the game than they get at Ajinomoto. And, notice, like, I mean, we can talk about, the crowd's only 3,700, but the tickets for the kind of Verdi supporters section behind the Verdi goal, those tickets sold out straight away. Because the hardcore fans want to get that. But this is the only game this season that's at Nishigaoka, so it's their only chance to kind of get close and see the team up close and personal in a home game context. So, I think it might be good if they could at least come to some arrangement where more games are played there. Or even if you've ever been to Komazawa Stadium, in Tokyo. It's again, it's not a soccer-specific stadium. It has a running track, but I don't know. There's just something a bit more compact than... like Ajinomoto is sort of like monolithic almost, isn't it?
Sure.
In its hugeness, so... I think we definitely move in towards Verdi are not going to attract more than sort of 4,000 or 5,000 fans ever, I don't think, unfortunately, just because of the population demographic of Japan and the damage that's been done to the Verdi brand by moving them from Kawasaki to Tokyo, and the timing of when that happened has kind of in some ways ruined the club, although I think the current ownership are doing a pretty good job of creating a kind of smaller, more kind of family-friendly sort of atmosphere there now. Mm-hmm. I think the takeaway for me would be Ajinomoto's not a viable long-term solution for Verdi because, like, as we said, it's just too big. It's not a football stadium. If they could... if I was running it, I'd be trying to negotiate to maybe either buy that Nishigaoka stadium or maybe try and rent it on a long-term lease and perhaps pay some funds to renovate it and make it kind of J-League ready, mm-hmm. If you like. I think the other option might be to move the goalpost, and I think we've touched on it before with Stuart. The J-League kind of licensing system is not really doing the job at the moment, I think. I think it's a lot of the conditions that you need for like a J2 license, for example, are just way over the top. To have 15,000 covered seats or whatever.
Right.
It's just, I think maybe that, I agree in principle with club licensing, because I think it probably prevents teams from going bankrupt at times, but there perhaps needs to be a bit more sort of case-by-case analysis of a club, whether they need 15,000 seats. I mean, we mentioned Mito and their strong start to the season. Well, they wouldn't be eligible for promotion anyway, because their stadium, even though it's quite new, doesn't meet the criteria for a J1 license. Mm-hmm. For example, they would need to add sort of like 3,000 seats, but their stadium's only ever 33% full now. So if you're as a businessman, you wouldn't add extra seats in that scenario. Sure. So maybe there needs to be a more joined up approach. Really, I think. From what I read on Twitter and kind of interacting with kind of mainly foreign J-League fans, I think there is a lot of, shall we say, friendly rivalry, and it's kind of, it's sort of fun to laugh at Verdi and kind of the plight they find themselves in after being the kind of giants of the early days of the J-League. But I don't think if people can just step away from that rivalry and see the bigger picture, it's not good for the league as a whole to see any club struggling with stadiums that are 90% empty, because it puts off investors, it drives down the TV or streaming viewing figures, I guess, now in the DAZN era. And it's not good to see any club. I mean, it kind of sends a shiver down my spine any time I see a headline of a J-League club having financial trouble, whether it's Ehime or Viva and Nagasaki even. It's hard to believe now, but this time last year, there's a lot of paper talk about their financial problems. That kind of thing just spooks sponsors and investors, and I think that would be bad news for the league as a whole if that happens. So I hope they can find some kind of solution that lets Verdi play shall we say, in a more appropriate setting for their needs.
Fair enough then. All right, so before we leave Verdi, John, just very briefly, you'd be pleased to know that I haven't prepared a quiz for you for this week's podcast appearance, but a question without notice. Can you say the name of Verdi's goalkeeper five times quickly?
The Verdi fans have a good chant where they can do it. I don't think I can. Do you want me to try?
Well, even getting through it once is quite a mouthful.
Okay. It's Kami Fukumoto Naoto.
That's right, that's right. Yes. Well done.
He has one of those names which, if you use the J League, the mobile version of the J League website, he has one of these annoying names which is just too many Roman letters that it doesn't fit on one line. So, if like me, if you like to take a screenshot of the teams to tweet out, he's one of the names that buggers that up, because if you have too many players with long names like that, the team list doesn't fit on one screen.
Gotcha, yeah.
So obviously I haven't been taking my ADHD pills, but I might have a word with him to see if he can get it shortened. Naoto would do. Naoto's fine. You know, there's only one goalkeeper, isn't there? There'll be no confusion.
Absolutely, yes. Naoto Kami Fukumoto. John got it first time, an absolutely tremendous effort. All right, John, just bear with me for a minute. I'm just going to round up for the listeners the results of the rest of the teams in the top six before I come back to you for a word or two on any or all of these clubs. So Oita went top for the first time this season after match day 10, after a dramatic 1-0 win at Kanazawa, Takuya Marutani grabbing the only goal of the game in second half stoppage time. Trinita moved above Okayama on goal difference after Fagiano, who had been top for the past 5 weeks, were held 0-0 at home by FC Gifu. Yamaguchi stayed third after an entertaining 2-1 win at Machida, with Zelvia, Dave Brooks, slipping out of the top six. They were overtaken by Verdi, also by Fukuoka, who rode a Takayuki Morimoto brace to a convincing 3-1 home win over Chiba, and also by Rowaso Kumamoto, who fell behind inside the first half hour away at struggling, and that's putting it mildly, Kyoto, only for Kohei Kuroki to equalise 9 minutes into the second half before defender Takuya Sonoda stole all 3 points for the Stallions with a close-range blast from Seiichiro Maki's knockdown in the 4th minute of stoppage time. And that was despite going down to 10 men with 20 minutes to go after Yuto Nakayama was sent off for a second yellow card. Now, John, we're obviously going to go big on Kumamoto, as Twitter user Gary Irwin demanded. But first, a brief word on any or all of the teams above them, or indeed any of the teams they've just played in match day 10.
Yeah, sure. I think we have to give Oita some love, because they're kind of one of the teams that don't get mentioned a lot on the pod, or indeed anywhere else. I think they're 7 games unbeaten now. The last time they lost was against Okayama, the team that they've just displaced from the top of the table. That was back in March. So 7 games unbeaten is a good stretch. I think they were a bit fortunate to beat Kanazawa with that late goal in the 93rd minute, like you said. But a win is a win. And then Okayama, I think, just starting to sense... I wasn't overly enthusiastic about them even when they were top, whether that was my ignorance. I hadn't seen them play any full games, but they do seem to be on the wane just at the moment. It's 2 draws in a row now, and I noticed they've only scored 3 times in the last 5 games. It's not the kind of goal scoring rate that's going to keep them among the front runners, I don't think.
Right.
I also just looked. I know they've won 6 of the 10 games so far, and you've probably picked up on this as well. But 4 of the wins were just the single goal, just 1-0. I mean, that's very impressive to keep so many clean sheets and take the points, but I'm not sure you can sustain that over the 42 games, you know, over the marathon. At some point, they're going to have to score more regularly, create more chances if they're going to stay up there. Yamaguchi, for me, are starting to look like maybe a team who could last the pace, I think. It was a good win. Apologies to the Machida Massive, who I know are keen listeners, but yeah, good Yeah, another good win for Yamaguchi there, Nozita. And I was just looking, I noticed, seemed to see the same goal scorers popping up again and again for Yamaguchi this season. I think they're the top scorers, aren't they? 19 goals from the 10 games.
Yep.
But I looked at this, in this game, Daisuke Takagi scored again. He's on loan from Verdi. That was his fourth goal this season. I had some time on my hands today, Ben, and I went back at looked at his J League record. His best ever scoring season, he only got 7. So he's on course to break that maybe by the end of Golden Week. And also Kosuke Onase, former Yokohama FC man, he scored the winner from the penalty spot in this game. That was his fifth goal this season. His previous best, and he's been a pro player for a while. His previous best 6. So he's only 2 goals away from having his, you know, personal best season.
Wow.
And I don't know if you haven't seen the highlights from this game, the assist that Ado Onaiwu gives, I'm not sure who it is who runs onto it, but an assist that he gives that leads to the penalty is real kind of J1 level play. And I think they've really they've played a blinder just by getting him on loan, because he is from Urawa, because he is going to be a flat track bully. I think I know that Joe is going to score 50 goals in J1. And I'm not sure Anaiwu is going to score that many, but he really does. If you watch the games closely, you can see that there's a player there who is just, he's almost a ringer. I think he's just at the wrong level.
Well, he's so on track to win the Golden Boot, John.
Well, yeah, he's the top scorer in the division. So he's got 6, Takagi 4, Onase 5. That's almost all the goals that Yamaguchi have scored this season.
Yeah.
So sort of if those three can stay fit and firing, I don't see why they can't stay up there at the top, especially because, as we've discussed in previous pods, the bigger teams, if you like, are really struggling at the wrong end, aren't they, this season?
Absolutely.
About Avispa, I think they're starting to click into the groove nicely, aren't they? 4 games unbeaten now since losing to Omiya last month. And on the same theme of kind of people having a sort of best ever scoring season, Takuki Morimoto, as you mentioned, got a brace against his old club, Jeff, in that 3-1 win. That's 5 for him this season. I was curious, he's only ever scored, he's the best in the J League, is a 10 goal haul a few years ago, whilst playing for Jeff, somewhat coincidentally. So he could maybe break his personal scoring record in the J League as well. He got 7 once for Catania, I think, one season in Serie A. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if goals in Serie A are worth more than goals in J2. That's a Twitter poll in the making.
Absolutely.
I will mention for Morimoto, he looks like he's really happy and enjoying his football. That might seem like a bit of a random observation, but a player who I've always really enjoyed watching. He's born in Kawasaki, not far from where I live now. Obviously, he was a youth team player at Verdi, where he kind of made his name before he moved to Italy. I don't think he had a great time of it personally, either at Kawasaki or at Jeff, so it's just nice to see him enjoying his football. I think he's found the right fit, club, the right club to fit him. So that's good. I have to mention Jeff because they've infuriated me.
Sure.
This season. That's 5 away games they've played, 5 defeats. Do you know how many goals they've conceded in those 5 defeats?
Well, they've let in 22 on the season. So in 5 defeats, they've just let in 3 at Fukuoka. I will say, well, I'll go 3 a game, 15.
Yeah, you're a good, you know your stuff. 16,
uh-huh.
Dave, that's averaging 3.2 a game. I don't know how long Juan Snyder, the Argentine coach, can hang on to the job if they just keep losing away games, and not just losing them, but getting blown away. I mean, the own goal that their defender, what's his name, the new Brazilian player, I forget his name now, but the own goal that they scored in this game Well, we won't go into it, but they've just got to do something about the defending. I think even now, Yokondo, the captain, who I know is a former Raysol player, just looks really past it to me, and I don't think he's getting much help from players around him. They're at the wrong end of the table too, and if they keep letting in 3 goals every away game, they're going to stay there. And yeah, we should talk about Kumamoto, because they're a much requested topic, I think.
Absolutely.
Judging by our Twitter correspondence. Yeah, so they're up into 6 now with that win away at Kyoto. I think perhaps a bit fortunate with the winner coming in the 94th minute as you mentioned. But they did come from behind, so it's always impressive when a team does that in an away game.
With
10 men, yes, not to be forgotten. I think that's only the second win that Kumamoto have ever had over Kyoto, so something to celebrate. And they're going well, aren't they? That's 4 games unbeaten, only 1 defeat in 7. I just looked as well, they had some pretty reasonable scalps at home this season. They've already beaten Tokushima, Omiya, and Niigata, which is pretty impressive. And none of those teams have had a particularly good start, I think it's fair to say, but that's not Kumamoto's fault.
Sure.
So, yeah, I think they'll have a chance. They're certainly surpassing my expectations. It'll be very interesting to see if they can maintain that for any length of time. Again, we mentioned Golden Week's coming up, the string of national holidays and a 3-game week, and they start that with an away game at Okayama. So we'll get a good chance to see if what they're made of in that game. That'll be a good examination of Kumamoto, I think. I just wanted to mention Kyoto very briefly as well.
Sure, their opponents from the weekend, yep.
Yeah, anybody who supports Kyoto should probably, turn off, maybe, get an early night. But they've lost 5 of the last 6 now with that defeat. And I think the coach there, Takahiro Nunabe, is in big trouble. I don't know if he'll survive much longer if they don't manage to turn things around. I'm not sure the squad is as bad as they look. I think they're bottom of the table now after the first 10 games. But, I don't think the supporters are happy. I've read a few tweets about kind of the fans staying behind after the game, and it's a very Japanese thing to do, but they demand an audience with kind of the sporting director or the coach. You know, they won't leave the stadium until someone from the club staff kind of comes out to talk to them. Usually with a megaphone, and the fans can let them know what they think. So I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised to see the sack race being won by the J2 sack. I don't think anybody's been sacked yet. Yeah, probably perhaps Nuno, poor old Mr. Nunabe might be the sack race winner in J2.
Yeah, it's not quite shocking in terms of Nagoya being bottom of J1, I wouldn't say, John. But, yeah, certainly you wouldn't have tipped Sanga would be at the bottom of the table, this far into the season. It's still early doors, but we are basically a quarter of the way through the season. And as you say, a lot can happen over Golden Week when the games come thick and fast. But, yeah, a stuttering start is a massive understatement. Yeah, Kyoto winning just 1 of the first 10, and it's... it's steamrolling in a similar way, I think, as it is with Nagoya. So there are some parallels there, no doubt. A couple of other results that I wanted to mention outside the top 6. Kyoto are bottom because of Saneki won at Tokushima. That was a shock 1-0 away win for Kamatamare at Vortis. It saw them surge all the way up to 20th. And the other 1-0 away win I wanted to mention was in the battle for relevance, as I billed it in last week's podcast, with Niigata hosting Omiya. And Ardija's Genki Omiya scored a brilliant free kick early in the second half to win it for Omiya, and they are now relevant again, and they joined Niigata on 11 points, but those teams occupy 14th as Niigata and 15th Omiya in the table. Omiya said he stole that in the first 15 seconds, I think. Johnny hit the woodwork basically right from the kickoff, so he was... He was after a goal the entire game, and it was good to see him score such an excellent free kick to a goal worthy of a game winner from Omiya. That's his 5th, I believe, of the season, so he's hot on Ado Onewu's heels. Did you have anything to say about the battle for relevance?
No, but I think you're right in saying that free kick was probably the goal of the weekend. Pretty low scoring weekend by J2 standards. I think there were only 17 goals scored across the 11 games. It can be, as you know, Ben, J2, you can literally pick a number and there might be that many goals in a weekend. But 17 was quite low. Yes, I'd suggest I agree with you. I think maybe Omiya's was probably the pick of the bunch just from a technical standpoint. I do think, though, and I hope Steve Barham would agree with me, he's quite a frustrating player. He will score a goal like that and have games where he he shows that he's a kind of J1, you know, quality player. I was pretty surprised he stayed with Omiya when they got relegated, to be honest. If I'd been a kind of middling J1 team, I probably would have tried to snaffle him for my team. So yeah, it's good to see that he's kind of, you know, sticking around to try and help them win promotion back to J1, although that's obviously very much a work in progress as we talk now after 10 games. But yeah, I sometimes find when talented players show up for a game, it just reminds you how much you'd like them to show up more and do that a bit more often. And I'm thinking of another, you know, former Akihiro Yanaga, for example, as a player who can just, when he just seems to get bored and then score a brilliant goal, like a technically brilliant goal, and just does nothing for another, you know, couple of matches. So, yes, I think Omai is probably the key this season for Omiya up front, but they just need to keep trying to get more out of him, I think. Okay, 5 goals in 10 games is probably doing his bit for the team, but I'm sure there's more to come from him. He's an extremely talented player.
Absolutely, I think he probably stayed because he likes the feel of the figure hugging Under Armour kits that Omiya have. But yeah, that's just my.
Well, hey, they hug some figures more than most, don't they? Those uniforms. So
I reckon, yeah. Yeah. That's just my own personal theory. And don't worry, Gary, I did want to say my own little piece on Kumamoto and to give them props, deserved props after their performance in the first 10 games. If Gary's been listening long enough, he will remember, of course, they were my dark horses to make the playoffs back at the start of the 2016 season. And they started the season well. They won 4 of their first 7. Before, of course, the prefecture was rocked by a series of devastating earthquakes that, well, it goes without saying, severely interrupted their season. The football became, you know, far less important, not only to the supporters and the players, but, yeah, everybody in the prefecture that suffered through those disastrous earthquakes. And they battled through the season. They ended up 16th. In 2016, and well, you know, you can't sugarcoat it. They went backwards terribly last year, and whether it was still a hangover of the struggles they had after the earthquakes, they finished second from bottom. They only had their J2 status preserved because Akita, who won J3 in 2017, didn't have a J2 license. So to see them finish 21st at the end of the 2017 season, and now to see them 6th. After 10 games of the new campaign is just absolutely fantastic. And, all we can do is hope that, the players can stick with it on the pitch because it's a great story. They don't have a great history of doing well in J2, but, this is a good opportunity for them to make some waves and to... hopefully, well, if they can stick around in mid-table and eventually maybe knock on the door of the playoffs, you never know. But, John, I went to the game at Kashiwa, one of the first games back after they started playing after the earthquakes with a couple of friends. And
yeah, I remember that, yeah.
It was just a great occasion. And, you know, ever since then, I've still got the scarf I bought that day. And, they basically have become my J2 team. So, don't worry, Gary. Certainly not ignoring Roasso. And, you know, now that they are fighting up in the top six, in and around the top six, we'll certainly hope to give them more coverage as the season goes on. But, John, they'll always have a little piece of my heart, I think, after, being at the stadium that day and seeing how passionately the fans have supported them in the face of such a disaster.
Yeah, it's difficult, I think, to describe to sort of non-football fans sometimes how it sort of generates a bond with people that you know, if you like football and somebody else like football, it's kind of there's a sort of almost like it's like a Freemason type secret society, isn't it, that goes with that. And sometimes the game, the 90 minutes, is just one aspect of that, and it's everything that's kind of, I don't know, people maybe sometimes feel they can express themselves in the stadium, especially feel like this in Japan, which is quite a societally speaking, quite a repressed, I think, in terms of how much emotion you can display publicly. I think sometimes when fans are in the stadium, when they're kind of united as a kind of one you know, one sort of super organism, if you like, behind the goal, and they put out those banners. I think that they're able to express themselves collectively in a way that I think Japanese society in general doesn't really allow them to do. So, I remember that game. I wanted to go to that one too, but for various reasons I couldn't. But I think we've seen it with Sendai as well, you know, in terms of the way that the kind of football family comes together pays respects and helps people in ways that maybe... it's hard to explain to someone, you know, like, it's just, on the one hand, it's just a load of blokes or ladies chasing after a ball, isn't it? It doesn't really mean anything, but, kind of think in times when people haven't got much, or they've got a lot of negatives in their life, it can be a really positive force. So, I think that's a memorable occasion, and it was a good thing that a lot of positivity came out of something that was obviously a sort of life-changing, tragic event, but people have to kind of pick up the pieces and get on with things somehow, and if football can help with that, I think that's a good argument for football in and of itself. Have you just tried to claim credit for tipping Kumamoto 2 years ago to be a dark horse, by the way?
Well, I was...
that was very smoothly... I don't think Stuart won't allow that. I think you might have something to say. I think you have to do it in the same season for it to be, you know, acceptable tippage.
I'm not sure I'm claiming credit. I'm just I'm appreciating the fact that they're doing so well. If they do happen to make the playoffs, you might conveniently forget this conversation ever happened, John. Yes, I might be claiming credit towards the end.
We're on to you, Maxwell.
All right. Well, my cover is blown. All right then. Well, that's terrific stuff. And very well said there, John. Thank you very much. And not quite the 20 minutes that you were after, I think, Gary. But yes, rest assured, we will continue to follow Roasso, on the podcast, and I will myself throughout the season. And yes, if you bet the under in Stuart's 25 minutes, then you definitely are in the money. All right, John, well, it's just about time to go, but J2 Match Day 11 will take place this coming Saturday. So, when I went to pick out a couple of fixtures for myself to talk about, I realised that if I was doing so at the start of the season, if I looked at the Match Day 11 fixture list, Omiya hosting Tokyo Verde and Kofu hosting Chiba would be, terrific fixtures to preview. But as it stands, only one of those four teams is currently in the top half of the table, and that's Verde. And, Omiya, Kofu and Chiba are all in the bottom nine.
Yeah, that's correct. I think that maybe makes the fixtures intriguing, but for different reasons than you might anticipate. I think for Omiya hosting Verde, that game's at 4 p.m. on Saturday. I think Verde, obviously, if they can avoid defeat, will make it 11 games unbeaten. I actually tried to find the Tokyo Verde's record unbeaten run, but I just couldn't find a link to it, or I didn't have the access to that. So if anybody... Sean Carroll or, you know, Dave Phillips, if you're out there, let me know what Verde's record is. I'm sure if they get to 11, then they're probably close to a club record for an unbeaten run there. And, Omiya, I think, just need to take that win that they had at Niigata at the weekend into this game and try and get their season back on track. Kofu versus Chiba, if Chiba lose another away game and ship three goals again, I just don't know if that they'll. I don't know if the manager will make it to the end to Children's Day at the end of Golden Week. Right, you know, right, yeah. I also thought a 2 p.m. Game, Mito against Kyoto, might be a good one. Similar reasons, really, kind of the vultures circling. If Sanga lose that one, I think perhaps they'll swap coaches with Jeff. You know, that might be the easiest way around it. And I also thought Oita versus Machida.
Well, that's the obvious. That's one of the obvious ones, I think, of the actual, proper, decent, good-looking fixtures on paper, yeah.
Yeah, because, in the past, teams tend to get into the playoff places or the automatic promotion places, and they don't know what to do when they've got there. So I'm interested to see if Oita can kind of, having kind of worked their way up to the top of the league, can they kind of give a commanding performance and hold on to it, or will Machida have a nasty surprise for them? I think Machida might have a nasty surprise for them, because we know Machida are a good team, and I think they'll be hurting after losing at home to Yamaguchi in the last game. So that would probably be a good one to take in on Saturday.
Well, yes, we need Machida to bounce back, because obviously after I finally got Dave Brooks on the podcast, the Machida lost their first game, and it's now two on the spin after that loss to Yamaguchi, so they need to get back to winning ways at the new leaders, Oita. Deposed leaders, Okayama, who of course is still second, they host the late game. It's a 7 o'clock kickoff on Saturday night against the previously mentioned and previously gushed about Kumamoto, so that's another fascinating looking game on paper. And then, we certainly hope to have both John and Stuart on the podcast next week, so then we can talk about match day 12 and beyond. That match day 12 fixture list, all the games will be played on Thursday the 3rd of May, a national holiday in Japan as part of Golden Week. All right then, John, I think that is J2 well and truly wrapped up for another week. And I tell you what, we'll struggle to have the J2 special last as long next week, I reckon. But we've done a tremendous amount of work there, I think. Thank you very much for your time again, John. And yes, I certainly hope to do it again with Stuart next week.
Oh yeah, no problem, Ben. It's always a pleasure, and I hope the listeners enjoyed it. And if you're watching a game this weekend or over Golden Week, have a good one and enjoy the sunshine.
Thank you very much. And of course, I plugged Sean's Twitter feed at the end of part one, so better do the same with John. It is, of course, at J2 Kanto Bites. I'm sure if you're a regular listener to the podcast, you're already following John. But if you're not, write that ship immediately, please. And that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. My thanks again to Sean Galbraith and John Steele, and of course to you for listening wherever you are. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast. Yes, 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 yes.